This is the Soil Sense podcast, where we believe that building healthier soils is not just a prescription, but rather a pursuit. It's a journey that requires collaboration, curiosity, and communication among farmers, researchers, agronomists, consultants, and extension. You're going to hear their stories and discover how and why they're working together to make sense out of what's happening in the soil. Hey there, welcome back to another episode of Soil Sense. I'm your host, Tim Hammerich. Today, Dr. Abby Wick and I sit down with Bismarck-based crop consultant Brett Peterson. Brett's been working at Central Ag Consulting for the past 15 years, alongside farmers to provide the best agronomic advice possible. He doesn't sell any products or anything, he's just paid to provide advice to make farms the best they possibly can be, which includes, of course, building the health of the soil and the productivity of the system over time. In today's episode, we talk about what's working on the farms Brett works with, mostly on the east and south sides of Bismarck. We cover how he incorporates soil health principles into his agronomic advice, how irrigation changes his approach, and the process of considering and adopting new ideas side by side with his farmer customers. First, though, I asked Brett to give us some context on the evolution of soil health building practices in his area.
From the get-go, we were doing the no-till thing. And when we started, you know, we were so heavy sunflower and small grain, very little corn, very little beans. And we had the equipment and the right equipment to do what we needed to do to preserve the soil and whatnot. But in a matter of 15 years from when I started to where we are now, we've learned the rights, the wrongs, and how to utilize our equipment, you know, what we can do that has worked, but hasn't worked. You know, they've been doing this for a long time, but I feel like in the last 5 to 7 years, we really have started to utilize the equipment and the knowledge we're gaining from meetings and, you know, social media too. You see things throughout the United States that people are doing, and everything's kind of gaining steam, and is gaining steam quickly to really do the right thing for the land.
Yeah, Brett, what does that process look like when you're seeing these practices and ideas on social media? How do you filter those ideas into something that's usable for your growers in your specific area? Do you have like a process for that, or is that just something you just inherently know?
Yeah, so I mean, the biggest thing is when you see things and new things, first and foremost, can this work on a large scale? We work with a lot of large clients, and the thing is you need to make sure that you're not stopping the process and slowing up the farm. You know, how can we do this on a larger scale, but do something that helps the soil, helps the farm, but isn't something that isn't feasible? I mean, there's certain aspects that you could do or try, but it's just not feasible in the day-to-day operation of the farm. So I would say that's the biggest thing. First and foremost, you got to just look at it. Is this even possible with a large amount of acres? Because at the end of the day, we have to get across the land and we have to make money doing this too.
Absolutely. Can you think of anything as an example of like you've thought, oh, that would be nice, but just not feasible operationally, logistically, to make it work with these big operations?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing that kind of jumps out to me is the intercropping. On a small scale, you know, that would work. But on a large scale, it's tougher. You know, the large scale wise, utilizing the rye across a lot of these farms, that's been huge. And that's easy enough to do. We can fill up a drill on the fall. We can put that into saline areas. We can get it across cornfields we've chopped just to get cover back on these fields. So yeah, I would say the rye has been the easiest thing to adopt just to get onto this land.
And when you said earlier, you said kind of like last 5 to 7 years, it seems like things have really hit a tipping point and kind of come together. You know, is the rye a big part of that? Or what do you suppose has happened that has sort of started to bring some of these concepts together and make things happen more quickly?
So the rye has been a big part of that. There's been a big push in ag for rye. And when you bring something up to some of these guys, it's run, not walk. So they see it, they're like, yep, that looks like a good idea. And before you know it, there's 3,000 acres of rye throughout the countryside. So that's been big. The meetings, the information we're getting through the universities from what they're seeing, that's been big. And then the peer information from the other consultants within our company, when you're able to share information, what's worked, what hasn't worked, that kind of accelerates everything also. when you have other people that have tried different practices and who you trust, you kind of know what works, what doesn't work. And that's sped up the process big time too.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. It's like a kind of a flywheel thing. You know, one person starts figuring it out and then the others, you know, hop on, and then them figuring out together just accelerates things.
Yep.
Yeah, I love that run, not walk comment, because I feel like, so as we move from the eastern part of the state to the western part of the state, the farm size grows. And so, like, what's the average farm size that you're working with, Brett?
I would say our average farm size across everyone is in that 7,000 to 8,000 acres. And some of the our clients, just great farmers. But when you introduce something to them that they think is going to work, it's large scale and it's very quick. So you better be right. You better really know what you are saying, because it's going to get done quickly. But I think everything's kind of seems, as you come this way, to be more, get across as many acres as you can. Also, timeliness, because of the extremes we've had in weather, they're used to going out and getting everything seeded very quickly and fast, utilize moisture. It's kind of just ingrained in those farmers to get across acres and do things quickly and be timely, just because we're always working on that clock. You know, the old saying out here is we're 2 weeks from a drought. I think that has a lot to do with it also.
So I think, Brett, you might be the first person, farmer or consultant, that's worked with irrigation. And you have some acres of irrigation, right? Or am I thinking incorrectly? Okay. How does soil health and management or use of cover crops, how does that change under irrigation systems?
So the one thing with the irrigation we learn quickly is, so a lot of these pivots come off of potato rotation. So when we get those pivots, there's no ground cover. It is shocking how far behind that corn, soybean, etc. falls behind in the growing season, just from purely sandblasting, the heat on that soil. So first and foremost, right away, we knew we needed to get cover on these pivots. So in the fall, first thing we're doing, we're ripping these pivots. We're getting rye seeded on the irrigation to get ground cover. We found that if we let that rye grow, we're way more money ahead killing that rye when it's in the boot stage and getting as much cover on that soil as possible to prevent the wind from damaging crop, the infiltration of the water absorbing in that soil, cooling that soil between the rows by having cover. The yields popped instantly. It was such a visual thing. And then we also saw it instantly when we were combining these pivots. That was the right thing to do.
When I think of rye and the management and killing it early, it's usually for moisture management. So with a pivot, you have, you know, you can apply more water if the seed bed is too dry. Or is that kind of a common practice?
Yep. So we, in the springtime or in the fall, we're out there strip tilling these pivots. And then we just let them be. And if we need to run water to get them in shape for seeding, we'll do that. So this year looks like we won't have to do that. We're currently in the process of stripping them right now. So yeah, they look great. The rye overwintered, excellent. So it's off to a great start.
That's great. And anything else on the moisture management? You know, so much of soil health, I have come to realize, you know, has to do with moisture management. So anything else irrigation related that you feel like you either have an advantage or a disadvantage when you're dealing with those acres?
Yeah, so the advantage with that land is the speed of growth. So we're able to push maturity. That is nice. Gain more yield that way. And then also with it being a lighter texture soil, we're able to no-till a lot of these pivots, so we preserve any corn silver covers. We're not adopting any tillage on these pivots when we're doing corn on corn, etc. We're just no-tilling right into them to preserve that stover on top, preserve moisture that way. Because at the end of the day, our weakest link is water. I mean, water and heat. It's shocking how hot that ground will get. I mean, if you put a thermometer in there middle of summer, on bare ground, when it's 150, 160 degrees and beyond. And when you preserve all that matter on top, keep it between the row, it's just such a better, healthier plant.
So somebody's going to ask, and you're the first for a lot of things, Brett. We have not talked with anyone who's working with potatoes in rotation as to like how you do soil health with potatoes. So can those words even be used in the same sentence? Or how do we approach that?
I think the biggest thing is what we're doing after the potatoes are on the irrigation is the biggest thing. I mean, you have to get some type of cover back out there, whether it's oats, barley, rye, to prevent the blowing of the soil. I think that could go a long ways with any potato grower. That ground is so black and churned up, and we're basically chasing the harvesters with drills just to get cover back on that soil. Because in a matter of days, I mean, in a dry spell, it's shocking how much topsoil you'll lose in a windy day. So, yeah, I mean, the biggest thing is just after you're done with that harvest, just to get that cover back on that ground.
Can you walk us through the rotation on those pivots? So if you have potatoes going into what next crops, and how you would maybe fit some of these cover crops or soil health practices into that?
Yeah, so typically they'll run a legume, whether it's an edible bean, a soybean, and then they'll go over into potatoes. We'll follow up with corn, and we've been trying to go corn on corn, kind of build up that stover, and then they'll follow back up, whether it be a no-till, a soybean, or go back to potatoes. If we have time in the fall after a soybean crop, we'll try to get a cover on right away after that harvest. Essentially, anytime we can in the fall or in the springtime, we've been also utilizing aerial application of cover just to get onto the sand ridges and whatnot. That's been very beneficial when we can't get there. We've had a pilot out of Napoleon. He's been up there putting on barley, oats, what have you, just to get cover to the ground.
And when are you usually doing that?
Right away in the springtime. Yep. So we've been doing a lot of that. Typically, 1st of May, if we can't get to a pivot, they're flying cover on right away.
I live in Idaho, so this is shameful, but I know very little about potato production at all. So I'd imagine there's no such thing as like no-till potatoes would be my assertion. But then they go into like no-till systems in between potatoes in the rotation. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. We're doing our best to do anything no-till or get cover back to the irrigation after the potatoes. I mean, there's nothing other than potato vines. I mean, after a harvest, it's very black exposed soil. So we're doing our best to try to build that soil back up in between potato rotation.
I think that's interesting because some might say like, oh, if you till it all, you lose all the benefits of, no-till, right? Or at least of long-term no-till. So are you seeing the good benefits of no-till in between versus, and I don't know if you have farmers that are tilling in between the potatoes?
Yeah. So in my mind, that's kind of a big misconception. If you have tillage here and there, within no-till. We have fields that have been no-tilled for years and years and years. But also when you do that, you'll start to get kind of a low pH zone up top. We found that you'll get so much kind of organic matter built up top in that soil, where if you can get tillage here and there, and it doesn't need to be heavy tillage, very light tillage, I would say every 5 to 8 years on a field, it almost, in my mind, it speeds up what we're trying to get out of no-till, increase organic matter, but also preserve the pH of that soil. And that's what we've been battling a little bit too on the dry land, is there are fields that we have found that can go backwards at times when you haven't done any tillage at all. I mean, and I'm not talking heavy tillage. I'm just saying that really light tillage to kind of churn it back up, that's been very beneficial. But it needs to be, every so often, not consistent. But that is the one, I would say, downfall of the no-till when you do it for a year on year and you really get a hot layer of a low pH up top. No-till isn't the end-all be-all. You have to really find that perfect mix of really light tillage, but preserving that top layer of organic matter and whatnot to keep that ground cover. It's kind of a teetering cycle that we're dealing with right now.
And then, so I imagine to reduce the negative effects of tillage, that's where these cover crops that you're mentioning come in to keep it from blowing away, as an example.
100%. Yep. And as far as tillage, I'm talking really light coulturing. Also, a great quote-unquote tillage tool that we've used, putting fertilizer down in the fall, which is an air seeder. it's enough to kind of break up the crop residues up top, but also it's preserving everything. And it's not like it's working it black, but it's enough to kind of break everything up, break it down, and kind of speed up that process to get that into the ground.
I'm really glad you clarified the light tillage because I've seen all kinds of versions.
Yeah, no, we don't want things black. It's surprisingly utilizing just a drill in the fall to put on fertilizer, that little amount is near perfect. In my mind, it's hard to sometimes convey to the farm how little a tillage I want to keep it a happy medium, because we don't want to see black fields. But there are times where we build up, if we've done a strong corn rotation and then a small grain in there, let's throw sunflowers in there. There's so much residue up top that at times we struggle to get good emergence, good warm up of the soils and whatnot. So we have to do something here and there, especially when you come off a big crop year, the amount of residue on top of that ground, it's incredible. But there are certain crops too that help negate that. Canola, for example, if you can get canola stand established into that heavy residue, when you are done with canola harvest in the fall, it is unbelievable how that will burn up that residue and convert that into that ground. But the corn, I mean, we've been so corn heavy out here. That's where I think people are starting to fight it a little bit. And that's where also crop rotation is a big deal to help with that also.
That's great. Do you find it harder to stay on the same page with farmers where you're like, well, I want a little bit of tillage, but not too much. And we want to do no-till as we can, but not, you know, not all no-till. I mean, does that make your job harder to kind of keep it as nuanced as that rather than we're going to go 100% no-till and then that's that?
I would say earlier in my career was tougher and we were also learning. You know, I would say there was a spell in there where we knew on some fields with the heavier soils, the tighter clays, that we needed to do something. We're quicker to react now and know when we should do something and when we shouldn't. If we come off a dry winter or we go into the fall and we're dry, we're not touching these soils. That plays into it a lot. If we're full of moisture in the fall, in the spring, we can quickly get away with doing something to help that ground, but also we know we're not setting that field up for failure. It's a matter of reacting and knowing when to react. Like I said, everything out here focuses on moisture. We need to preserve our water so we can get through July, August. So when we're dry or we're in a dry pattern, I mean, it's something you don't even bring up because we just know and the client knows it's just not the time to do these things. So I would say that's where we are on the same page and it's gotten a lot better. We know when we need to do something. We know when we shouldn't do something. We also go over what fields potentially are fields that we need to do something. And it's only, I would say, with each client, a handful of fields. It's not many fields. But when we have those fields that, let's say, higher water table, heavier clay, they're cold in the springtime, those are the ones that we need to react at the right time to do something and then go back and do our no-till process.
You know, how would you characterize, and I'm sure it varies quite a bit, but your client's interest in finding new ways to kind of improve their soil over time, even if they're not maybe going to see that productivity gain in the short term?
You know, most people we're working with are very open to trying these new things. Whatever we can do to try new things to preserve water, if we can have the water out here, the crops that we can grow are fantastic. So if there's something out there that we can try, we can do, most clients are very open to it and trying it. We just had a client kind of go full in on strip tilling because he has a lot of that ground that's a happy medium, but we also know we need to conserve water. We need to keep our residue. But some of this ground, we need a little bit of a black strip in the springtime to get this crop off to a running start and not delay emergence. So that's been fun to see. That's really starting to work out well. So yeah, no, everyone's pretty open to trying new things and kind of being on the cutting edge of new things out here. So that's made my job very enjoyable. A lot of progressive farmers that want to do better and be better.
As we go out west, I get a lot of questions about, you know, if I use a cover crop, it's going to use up too much moisture in these dry systems. And so how do you get around that? Because obviously you're using cover crops to build residue. So how do you navigate that conversation?
Yeah, so that's one thing initially you really think about. I'm going to suck up the water. We're going to be dry, what have you. You know, really, we need to make sure that we're covering that ground. So when we hit that next spring, you know, it doesn't take a lot of rain to recharge that ground from that cover in the fall. Okay. Essentially, the mindset they need to go into is we need to get through July and August. No matter how wet we are, we're going to hit that 2-week spell where the furnace is going to be turned up on us. We're not going to have any rain. And that's kind of the make or break for a lot of our crops, okay? So I think that's really shifted because initially I had that same thought too. What if we burn up that small amount of moisture in the fall? But really, I mean, you have to focus on the following year. What do we need to do to preserve that crop for the following year? Well, it's getting ground cover.
I'm totally going to use that argument because I've struggled with that for like a dozen years. How do you convince somebody that using the moisture in the fall is the best thing for the next year?
So I've gone out with people also. They don't realize, and a lot of people don't realize, and I didn't realize in the beginning, how hot that bare soil gets in the middle of summer down by that plant. You put a thermometer in at 2 inches, and that soil, that surface temp, it blows past 100 degrees. The middle of the day, I mean, you'll hit 150, 160. And you think of that, these plants then are just baking. You know what I mean? And then when you go out and you start checking moisture with a soil probe and go between a row where it has a good cover, instead of sitting there and stepping on a soil probe trying to get in the ground, you'll put that soil probe right in the ground and pull out a foot of moisture that you can make a mud ball in your hand. A lot of times, middle of summer, a lot of farms out here have been through the droughts. And I'll hear it all the time is, oh man, it's dry. This crop is going to be burning up. And you have to tell them, I can still get that soil probe between the row, make a mud ball. We are fine. We're going to burn up on that subsoil, but we have more than enough moisture to make it through. And we've started to see that where you'll get people call you in the fall and they're shocked kind of the yields they're getting, but it's because of that process we've been doing for years and years. We can get through those hot spells and we're making it through and getting this crop to maturity. And it's pretty wild when you conserve that water and have that residue between the row, how long that plant can survive with good residue cover.
Since you've been in this, Brett, for 15 years, what is your recommendation to somebody that's just starting to work in soil health as a consultant? What would be the piece of wisdom you would give them?
So I would say the biggest piece is don't be scared. You're going to learn things. You're going to know what's right or wrong for your area. But also don't get stuck in a rut of wanting to just do the same thing every year. I think we're all guilty of that. I know I'm guilty of that. You know, we only have so many years with these clients to change this land, help them with their farms, do what you can to get started with it. Don't give up on it. Also, try bring something new to these clients every year so you can learn, they can learn. I mean, if you have a chance, anyone out there in the summer to drive around and get west of Jamestown, it's quite remarkable how much the area has changed because of the no-till. I mean, and I feel like it can work and you have to know the situations where it can work. And just work as a partnership with your client to find the things they want to do, what you want to do, and just don't give up on it. It's really not expensive to try these things, but you have to be persistent and you really have to have a goal together on what you want to achieve.
Well, what a great message to round out today's episode. Thank you to Brett Peterson for being on the show. Abby and I asked what he's thinking about next. And in general, he said getting more into strip till and more into using drills as a tillage pass and putting down cover. But he also said the biggest challenge is trying to fine tune the fertility recommendations to make sure that the fertilizer program is adequate for especially some of these good areas that are yielding a lot more than expected given some of these practices. Great perspective all around from Brett there. Well, thank you so much to our sponsors of this season of Soil Sense, the North Central Sustainable Agriculture Research and Education Program, the North Dakota Corn Council, the North Dakota Wheat Commission, the North Dakota Soybean Council, the North Harvest Dry Bean Association, the North Dakota Barley Council, and Anheuser-Busch. If you're getting value from these shows, please leave us a rating and a review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or both if you have them, and share your favorite episodes on social media using the hashtag SoilSense. We'll be back with more great soil health content in a couple days.